Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight, episode 160 for comics originally released on September 1st, 2010. Now, starting us off in DC is Freedom Fighters number 1. This is by Palmiotti and Gray. And this is kind of sort of a follow-up to the Two Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters series they did. Was that like 2 years ago now?
I don't exactly remember when they were, but I liked them. Now this one, those had, who was on art on those? At least the second one had that kind of painted style.
I don't remember the artist, but this is a different artist. It's not a bad artist here, but, you know, it's been a while since I've read either of those 2 8-issue miniseries, but I recall really enjoying both of them and being really impressed with kind of how they started and what all they managed to accomplish. And while I thought this was a good issue, I really don't think it was as good of an opening issue as either of those 2 miniseries had. You know, there are a couple of things here at the beginning where they were clearly starting with action for the sake of starting with action. Which, you know, I get the temptation to do that, and it was not bad action, but like this Aryan Brigade or whatever we've got here at the beginning. This is a villain group that I really don't see the need to ever see again and kind of hope we don't.
They're a very unappealing group. I will give you that. But if you want to set up, a group that you can really get to hate in, you know, I think this is a good one.
It is, but this is a better writing team than that to fall on such an easy writing crutch.
Right.
You know, the other thing is then because that was with Firebrand and Black Condor. So we set those two up, get some action there. Then we go set up the Human Bomb with one thing and Phantom Lady and the Ray with a different piece of action, and they have to kind of switch it up and stuff. And the way they solve this whole bit with the asteroid, I'm like, I've seen that episode of Stargate. But, you know, it at least was kind of fun or whatever, but it was good action. I enjoyed the action. We got some good character moments. We got to see, you know, the members of the team. They got established. It just felt a little, by the numbers, a little forced. And really, it's not until well after the staple that, you know, we actually start to get to the beginning of the actual story arc. And, I mean, they set it up fairly well. The reveal on the last page I found pretty interesting, and I'm like, okay, I'm curious to see where that goes. And it's clear that this Freedom Fighter series is going to have a, I guess, nationalistic flavor to it, unsurprisingly. You know, playing up, you know, the whole Americana thing in a variety of ways. So I think that's going to help set this team apart from the plethora of teams in the DC Universe right now. But frankly, I think if you weren't a fan of this team going in, I'm not convinced this issue would make somebody one.
No. I don't know. I think the attitude someone needs to take on this, and I looked it up, the first series was in 2006, mm-hmm. and it had the Daniel Acuna art, which is the one I was thinking of. The second one had Renato Arlem art, and it was in 2007. So it's been 3 years since we've seen one. But this one, I would say that this is not a standard DC superhero book, right? I mean, you got the superhero action and everything, but it kind of breaks away from the standard feel, at least for me, of a DCU superhero book. And that's who this book is going to appeal to. I'm not sure that it's kind of like, if you're not a fan of the Freedom Fighters, you're not going to like this. I think it's more like if you want just another standard DCU superhero book, you're probably not going to like this.
Well,
and if you're looking for kind of a change of pace, this might be a refreshing change of pace for somebody.
I agree with you on that, but I didn't say that if you didn't like the Freedom Fighters, you wouldn't like this issue. What I said was if you didn't like the Freedom Fighters going in, I didn't think this issue would make you a fan of the Freedom Fighters as a team. Because they, introduce the characters, but not really set them up in any way of, okay, these are cool characters I've just got to follow. They essentially get them all on stage. This was one where, while we had some action up front, it was very much a setup issue, and really the entire first half of the book is setting the characters, getting them on stage, so we can then start the thing and get the team introduced to walk into the, hey, we've got a mission for you kind of a scene. So I don't feel that there's enough meat here to think, wow. I mean, because yes, this is a different kind of a team, and I think you get the flavor for that, but there's really not enough here to make you fundamentally care at any kind of a deep level for any of the main team members.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but...
Okay.
I mean, I think you got a team book. It's hard to pull everybody in on the team in 22 pages and get that going. I mean, there's little snippets of each character and what they can do. You've got the updated power matrices for each one of these characters. They're not characters that you see all the time in the DCU. So you have some things that they're doing that are kind of cool. And, you know, the Phantom Lady, she's got different powers than Phantom Lady had a long time ago. I mean, she's got the power set is the same that she's had lately, but she hasn't been used a lot lately.
Well, you know, none of these characters have.
You know, opening the portals with the black light bracelets, and, you know, Uncle Sam's got a slightly different power set and all that. And it's, we get a little bit of introduction there, and I think there's enough that individually someone might say, okay, I like that character. That character's cool. Did they get into everybody completely? No. I mean, you didn't get a lot of Ray. You didn't get too much Black Condor. You know, I think you got a little more on Phantom Lady and Uncle Sam, but they're arguably the top two draws on the team, because one's a pretty girl, and, you know, Uncle Sam is kind of like the face of the team.
Yeah, but the funny part is, the two that have actually had their own books for any length of time are Black Condor and the Ray. Now, granted, I think nobody really remembers the Black Condor series, but the Rays lasted for, I'm thinking, 2 years or something, but even that was many, 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 many years ago. I guess part of it for me is, we've read a couple of first issues, you know, recently that I think did a really good job of setting up the scene from really a blank slate. Things like Morning Glories, things like that, where, you know, they had the readers had no predisposition pro or against the characters going in, and they were able to set that up pretty well. Whereas here, we got introduced, yes, we get to see the power sets, we get a little bit of the character and stuff, but it was more in a perfunctory manner to get the story moving than, I think, to engender, you know, a strong connection and fan following for these characters. I'm not saying that won't build. I'm not saying people won't have that. I'm saying I'm not convinced they did a top-notch job, certainly just in comparison to the previous two first issues of the Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters things, where I thought they started off with a much stronger start. Now, certainly there's a fair amount of story in here, and that helps. And it's not a bad issue, but given these characters have been pretty much out of circulation for the most part over the last couple of years, really the few times they've been used seem to have been as sacrificial lambs in, you know, event-type books of, oh yeah, the Freedom Fighters got wiped out again or whatever. The fact that we never see the Heartland, we never kind of fill in some of the gaps of where the team's been and what they've been doing over the last few years, I was a little disappointed with. We may get that later. I can understand not putting that in the first issue. But, you know, this is one that I suspect is going to be a bit more of a standalone team title over at DC than your average one, just because it's not connected to everything else like the Justice League, the Justice Society, the Titans, the Outsiders, or, you know, half the other teams out there. And I think that's something that, like you said, will appeal to a lot of fans that just want a different kind of a DC team book, because this certainly fills that.
Well, I think it would appeal to a lot of fans, but I don't know how many fans are actually going to try it.
There, you know, is that.
Problem with any kind of book that's not, that's kind of off the beaten track. I mean, you're going to get some people over that want something different. And this not good art, well-told story. I mean, I can't disagree with some of the points you make. But, you know, at the end of the day, you got a first issue, and not everyone, and not every first issue is going to follow a, you know, a set format that's going to do certain things. I mean, Palmiotti and Gray made a certain choice here to try to pull people in who didn't have, I would imagine, didn't have familiarity with the characters, because they're not the most popular characters in the world. It's been 3 years since their last series, so they're, you know, kind of trying to pull in with some action. You know, could they have done some different things? Sure, but I thought it was an effectively done first issue. I got some good action scenes and got some good spotlight of powers and personalities on some of the characters. You know, I mean, in Black Condor, they could have done more with him again, but, you know, you got a little bit of his personality type in that first fight.
They're probably covered more of the personalities and stuff like that I'm giving them credit for, and I think that's fair. I guess the thing is, I agree with you entirely that a lot of people just simply aren't going to try this. So I think that while they covered a lot of ground and certainly gave a lot of value for the money, I think there's a lot of story here and a lot of content here, more so than a lot of comics I've read. Is it enough that if they actually get somebody to try this first issue, that they're going to stick around for the second? And I'm not totally convinced of that. I expect this one to sell mid-30,000, so we'll say ballpark 35,000 for the first issue, just because it's a stealth title. DC did not promote this. They didn't do a good job launching this. You know, it just kind of came out. So that's going to...
Yeah, I don't remember seeing a whole lot of a push for it all. It's just going to kind of show up on the stands and...
So, you know, as much as Palmiotti and Gray are doing and with the meat in this story, which, again, there's a fair amount of, that only matters to people who actually pick up that first issue. And then is it enough, like I said, to get to the second? I hope it is. I'd like to see Palmiotti and Gray continue with this. They've done some interesting stuff with this team, taking it in different directions and making it not just another DC team title. And that's hard to do.
And that's my main thing is, you know, it's going to appeal to people who want something different but don't feel comfortable going out and actually buying indie books that much, you know. And there's a lot of fans like that. You know, they don't really go out and buy books from the smaller publishers. And this is kind of a compromise on that. Compromise is a bad word. Compromise is a bad connotation to it. It's a good middle ground, let's say, between a mainstream superhero book and kind of a little more edgy non-Marvel DC superhero team.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I'm just not you know, it's great, but I'm not sure how well that's going to be absorbed by the standard fans that pick these kind of things up.
Well, I mean, the unfortunate truth of the matter is it's a rough time for comics to gain traction and a readership and just kind of get a foothold in the market. And this is the kind of thing that because Freedom Fighters are a more obscure team that, and again, this issue didn't really get any kind of promotional push to speak of, this is a hard sell. It's good, but it's an uphill battle for these guys. And, you know, I wish them well. I hope it sticks around. Like I said, they're doing good stuff here. I just think that because it's such an uphill battle, I really would have liked to have seen them just totally knock it out of the park on this first issue. And for me, they didn't do that. I think this is a strong 3 out of 5. Almost could have given it that 4, but not quite. And, you know, I think in this kind of a market... They really needed to come out of the gate with just a solid 5 out of 5 to wow people, to get the interest, to get the buzz, to get people to try the book out.
You know, for me, it was a solid 4 out of 5. It was a 4 out of 5 book, above average. I really liked the art.
Yeah, the art
but,
was good.
You know, it was not, like as you said, you know, it wasn't a 5 out of 5. It didn't totally blow me away, but, you know, maybe 5% of books actually do like that. So that's not a knock. I mean, it's firmly on my pull list. I think I thought it was a really good book, and I thought it was a really good, you know, fresh change of pace from other things. And that's what I would recommend it for. You know, people who want to see some characters that don't get explored that frequently and who are interesting in their own right with some good art and and good stories told about them, they should check the book out and see what they think.
Yeah. Well, and again, the fact that it is just different. It's got a nationalist feeling to it because you've got aspects of Americana, and there's some patriotism there, but not in a overly political manner or anything. I mean, the fact that Black Condor is an American Indian, you know, we've got the human bomb almost symbolically representing kind of the, not the war aspect of the country, but the fact that we occasionally blow some stuff up, you know, and things like that. It's just a fundamentally different kind of a take on superhero books, and that is why I really hope they're able to gain that foothold, get some traction, and keep this thing around. So we'll see how it does.
But, you know, for listeners, you know, if you see it out there, you want to try something new, give it a shot. You know, give it a try and let us, you know, send us an email and let us know what you thought of it. Because I think it's a good book. I think it's well worth the $2.99 and is a good read.
Yeah.
It's better than, you know, 75% of the DC books that I'm reading lately. So.
Yeah, there's certainly a ton of DC books I would cut long before I would cut that one. No question about that. So it's, yeah. Shall we move on?
Sure. And the next we've got from Marvel is the last of a 4-issue series, Hercules, Twilight of a God. This is set in kind of a parallel, not parallel, but a future Hercules history that has been explored in a couple of previous miniseries that Bob Layton has worked on. Hercules is out in space, kind of a space empire, and you know, this, I'm not certain that this series is one that, kind of like anything, you can't really pick it up cold, particularly. I think that having a little bit of context on some of the previous ones would help. Although, I mean, I think you can read it without those. Just, you're going to lose some of the material, you know, like his relationship with the Skrull Skippy and, you know, the family members, and when the recorder makes the appearance, you know, why that has any kind of particular significance, and, you know, things like that. That said, I enjoyed the series. I thought there was a nice conclusion to it here without ruining anything. I liked the introduction of the new character or the characters at the end of this, and somehow they really closed this off and tied it up in a bow, really. I would like to see some new stories in this particular continuity.
Well, I think this was kind of interesting because it's got some classic old school Hercules fun, you know, and kind of that 80s style, which is when the previous two miniseries in this stuff came out. I think being aware of those miniseries certainly helps because you know that there was the Skrull, the recorder, whatever. I don't know that you really have to have read them, because I think I've read one of them, but not both. I may not have even read, I think, I read one of them. I got the other one hidden in my back issues downstairs in my to-read stack there. So an awareness of it is good, but I think this stands alone pretty well, as long as you're willing to go in thinking, okay, this is Hercules in the future, in space, with a new cast of characters, you know, and run with it. They do a good job, I think, establishing those relationships fairly well. As for the ending here, this to me is a beautiful blend of giving a good sense of closure for both this miniseries and kind of this arc of Hercules, including the other two miniseries, but also, like you said, with those characters introduced, there's an implied kind of a new beginning to potential stories that could be told. Now, I kind of doubt they will be, but I agree with you. I'd love to see them. I think they've set just some interesting stuff up there. And this is kind of a fun universe to play around in. But it had that nice, again, blend of closure for this, and more stories can be told, so not just, okay, we're done, we can never come back to this. It was, again, a nice blend of that. Now, I think if you've been enjoying the Incredible Hercules series, you would probably enjoy this series and the previous two. It's got that same sense of kind of that fun-loving Hercules. He's just in a different stage in his life. He's quite a bit older because it's a few centuries later. He's got kids, grandkids, again, different supporting cast. But I think it's got a similar enough sensibility to it that a lot of people, I think, would like it and, you know, enjoy it. You know, because in some ways it's very similar to the Hercules we've had recently. Other ways it's a bit different, but again. And it had a nice feel of the 80s style of comics, and I mean that in a good way. There's a fair amount of story in here. Things keep moving. It's not one of these modern-day decompressed, you know, take three issues to tell a two-minute conversation. And that's an exaggeration, of course, but you know what I mean. So I really enjoyed this. I thought it was good.
And maybe it would cause people to go out and seek out some of the previous Hercules series that, I mean, you have one maybe kind of sitting in your back issue bins somewhere, you know, do that. And it's been a long time since these series came out. I mean, I think that...
If I'd had the time and didn't have a number of other boxes piled in front of my back issue boxes, because my reading room's gotten a little chaotic lately, I definitely would have dug them out and read them. Because I thought this was just fun stuff. I mean, you know, seeing Hercules, the Skippy the Skrull, the Recorder, all that stuff, his kids, his grandkids. It's a fun universe rife with possibilities. I felt I wasn't missing anything because I hadn't read them. And the other one I would have read back when it came out in the 80s. So I've got vague recollections.
Came out, the first one came out in 1982, and the second one came out in 1984. And they've both been reprinted in one of those Marvel Premier Classics hardcovers.
Mm-hmm.
Number 30 is the one that they were done in. It was, you know, Hercules, Prince of Power by Bob Layton, and it collects both of those previous series.
Yeah, and again...
That came out like 4 years ago.
Yeah, this is good stuff. It's interesting Layton's going back to, I don't say glory days at Marvel, but you know what I mean. Bringing this back, he did the Iron Man, Doctor Doom one a while back. So kind of almost finishing off some theoretical trilogies he'd worked on. So, I enjoyed this, like I said. I thought it was good. I think the story played fair. So, if one or two things I kind of saw coming, but still really enjoyed it when it got to that point in the story. This, to me, was a solid 4 out of 5.
I gave it the same. Again, I do think that it would have more of an appeal to people who are familiar with the previous storylines. And that's kind of the interesting part about when you come back and you revisit something from 20 years ago. You know, there's that element where, you know, how much of it is playing to, you know, this particular audience that knows that stuff actually even existed.
I certainly think that you get more out of it if you've read that because you've got more of a connection, more of a backstory, more of an appreciation. But I think as a standalone miniseries... the characters were introduced, set up, and all that, fine. You know, I think you get enough out of it without that. Do you get more with it? Certainly. But I don't feel you're missing anything, whereas I feel there have been a few other things where if you don't have the backstory going in, you're just a little bit lost. And I certainly didn't feel that way at all with this. So.
Yeah, I think the main thing for me that drove my point home on this issue was the grandmother.
That's fair. I can see that.
You know, because it's like, why was she so bad and what actually happened in the past and that kind of stuff. I mean, you can, I don't think you lose a lot from the story. I mean, because you can tell from the context, okay, you know, this and this happened and this is what the opinion is and everything like that. But, you know, not having, you know, actually remembering what, you know, from the old stuff, I think that is a bit of a drawback, you know, because there's, you know, it's like we've talked about before where it's, they're telling you something instead of showing you something.
Yeah, but I guess to me that kind of a referencing a previous story is understandable to tell, not show, because they've already shown it.
Right.
But they at least tell enough to give you to make the story make sense, whereas if it's just, well, you know what happened with her, and that was all they said, I'm like, no, I don't. Then I would have been, frankly, really annoyed. So... But I can see, based on that specific part of it, where having read those that stuff with that character in the past would add a lot to that particular part. I'm assuming that's the miniseries I haven't read, but it may have been the one that I read back when it came out, and I just don't remember that.
It's been, like, you know, 25 years. You know, it's like memory's going to fade over that time. And the other part, and I do remember, is, you know, the reunion with the recorder.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, recorder, is that you? Or be that you? Thou art kind of creepy looking, you know? And it's like, I mean, he had a very strong relationship with the recorder in the previous series. And that added a lot, you know, to me, because I could remember that, you know, quite clearly. You know, the Rigelian recorder was one of the main characters in the other series. And again, it didn't detract from the issue, I don't think. I just think it, if you have that, it added something.
Yeah, well, I would recommend this to fans of Hercules, and I would recommend the other two, you know.
Yeah, and the easiest way to do it is to, like, go out and try to find that premiere hardcover, because tracking down the two miniseries from that long, well, I don't know.
Actually, I'm pretty sure I got it from my comic shop, that second one, for like a buck a piece or something. I mean, it was not that much. It's worth looking for the back issues.
I guess, you know, the thing is, now that you make the point, we can just talk a little bit about this. Back 25 years ago, they printed so many more copies of comics than they print today, you know, sales-wise. I'm guessing that.
Well, let's put it this way.
In 1982, a book selling what the top books sell today would have been canceled, you know, for low sales.
Yes. A low-selling book there would have exceeded a high-selling book now.
Yeah, I mean, they were selling over 100,000 books of even, you know, poorly selling books. So there should be plenty of these issues kicking around back issue bins various places.
Over at mycomicshop.com, they've got the 1982 series, all four issues in near mint. The first two issues are $1.30. The third is $1.10. The fourth is $1.70. And the 1984 series is $1.70 for the first three issues, $2.30 for the fourth in near mint.
So basically, for about $10 or so, you can pick up all eight issues, maybe about $12 or something.
And they've
certainly
got
less than the hardcover would cost.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're out there. They're available. I think they're worth checking out.
Okay, you want to move to our indie choice here, which is Incorruptible number 9 from Boom Studios. Now, this is an adjunct title to Irredeemable that focuses on the Plutonians' major foe, Max Damage, as the main character. And while the Plutonian has gone evil, he was kind of like the Superman analog, biggest hero, and he's gone rogue and, you know, bad. Max Damage was the bad guy, and he's rethought his life and has actually trying to turn over a new leaf and become a good guy to fight against the Plutonian.
Now, what I found interesting is this is obviously a companion title, Irredeemable, like you said. And while it's set in the same universe, in the same time as Irredeemable, it's very much had its own storyline. Now, this issue is really kind of the first time we get major backstory between the Plutonian and Max Damage. Certainly it's been alluded to, talked about, but not, it's just, okay, he's a villain, kind of, and they've had fights sort of thing. Now we get some actual meat to the backstory, specifically when Max kidnapped the Plutonian's girlfriend at the time. So there's a lot of flashback stuff here, and it's really one of the issues that's had the tightest connection, I think, to the Irredeemable storyline.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also one that, while I'm not sure who would be reading just Incorruptible and not Irredeemable, I think you can, even now, and have no problem with it whatsoever. It's got its own narrative thread and is keeping that pretty well. Now, it's written by Mark Waid. So, I mean, the writing is just top-notch because the guy's a great writer. There's a lot of exposition in this issue because of the flashback, stuff like that. But it all makes sense and is accompanied. We're actually seeing the events that we're flashing back to. It's not just somebody lecturing. So I was okay with the amount of flashback and the amount of kind of info dump that happened because it really needed to. The one thing I think needed to be clearer in this issue is the jailbait character in the flashbacks is not the same person as the one currently wearing the costume.
Now, that's true.
That's clear if you read the previous issue, but if somebody's just coming in because, oh, wow, they're going to have the Plutonian in this or whatever, they're going to be a little lost on that. So I think as far as this issue goes, he could have made that clearer. But again, overall...
I think that they have it in the little previously blurb inside, if you read that in the front cover. So if you're not reading the book and you read that, because it does say accompanying Max to Sky City is the new jailbait, an of-age partner whose family was murdered by the Diamond Gang. So,
yeah.
You know, it does have a little bit of a touch to that for people who have not been following it. I would imagine if you weren't reading the series on an ongoing basis, you'd read that previously blurb.
That's
which
fair.
Which I tend to skip over, you know, because I'm reading it.
I was going to say the same thing. Because I've read the previous issue, I skip over it, go straight to the story, figuring they need to do enough in the story to jog my memory of that previous issue. You know, I shouldn't need to read a recap of it, which frankly sometimes, not necessarily here, but just across the board, I've seen places where they don't play fair.
Which,
and they
actually... again, worked for you in the story because you knew that.
Yeah.
But again, for someone who's coming to this new, they would read that previously blurb. That's what that's there for. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked how Wade is delving into that backstory now, and you're kind of getting the, you know, some of these glimpses into Max's old life. Plus, he does get in there, you know, and every once in a while, every few issues or so, he works into the narrative of the story in, I think, a good way, a little bit of info on how Max's powers work. You know, which
yeah.
is, you know, the longer he's awake, the more invulnerable he becomes. But, you know, you're awake a long time and you start getting some impaired judgment and stuff. You know, you get a little sleepy and all that kind of stuff. You know, he worked that into this issue to remind people of that. And again, I don't necessarily need that because I've been reading the whole series, but he works it in for new readers.
The problem I have with that was in the story revealed last issue. In the inside front cover, it was revealed in the first issue. And I think if they had not revealed it there, but we, you know, see he's got all the stuff and then, you know, he gets shot and, you know, whatever, it didn't bounce off. We're like, huh? And revealed it then, that might have been more interesting. In other words, I think that information should have come out of the story, not the material around the story first. You know, it's about the only major gripe I've got with the way the inside front page has been done. Because really, they do a good job doing it as kind of a FBI Most Wanted poster. And how many times have we talked about comics needing to have an inside front cover that kind of sets the scene, gives you the premise, gives you what you need to know to where you can come into any issue and just kind of go running? This does that. I just feel that in the past, they revealed a little more information than they should have. So, this is a book I totally recommend. Obviously, I recommend Irredeemable again. I think Wade's just a fabulous writer, knocking it out of the park on both of these books. It's one of those that the series, both of them, this one and Irredeemable, as a whole, are just a step above almost any particular issue because there's a building to it. This universe is getting continually fleshed out. We're getting more about it, and you know, I think it gives you the ability to go back to previous issues and pull more out of the story because you've got more of a background, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like it because, you know, I mostly like to read, you know, superheroes in the Marvel and DC universe. And when I go outside of Marvel and DC, I've said this before, I tend to read non-superhero titles more predominantly. When I do read a superhero-ish title outside the Marvel and DC universe, I like it to be a very unique or different take on superheroes that I would not get from Marvel and DC. And this is absolutely one. I mean, this is not a storyline that you would see in a Marvel and DC comic. And that's why I like, you know, the combo of Incorruptible and Irredeemable, you know, those two books. That's if you want to see an alternate take on superheroes, and you know, you've mostly read Marvel and DC books, just picking up those two books, that's a great way to get that, you know, kind of refreshing different take. on the heroes, I think.
I completely agree, because while these characters could have, prior to the events of Irredeemable Number 1, existed in a Marvel or DC universe, the storyline of the Plutonian flipping out and everything that happens after that, including Max Damage deciding, you know, hey, I've seen the light, I'm going to go good, couldn't have happened in a Marvel or DC universe. You know, and if it did, it would have been a 6-8 issue miniseries event thing, boom, it's over, it's done, that's that. Whereas Wade is able to play out the storyline here in a detailed, intriguing kind of a manner, where we're seeing Max kind of struggling with trying to go good. We're seeing, you know, the former teammates of the Plutonian struggling to, well, survive. And just how a world reacts to their top superhero, again, completely flipping out, vaporizing a city, and going on a rampage. You know, that's a game changer. And the fact that Wade's taking it and saying, okay, that's now our status quo, let's go from there, fundamentally different. You know, we've had things in the past where somebody would do, okay, there's a big superhero fight and they destroy the city, you know, whatever. It's a one-shot. Overdone, that's it. You know, this is really the first time I can think of we've got not one but two ongoing titles exploring the aftermath of what would have been just a one-off what-if story at Marvel or DC, and doing it exceedingly well. So, definitely books I recommend. One thing I will say about the art here is I think they did a really good job, you know, taking the flashback scenes and making them feel different to where it was pretty clear, okay, now we're out of the flashback, we're going to the main story, stuff like that. There have been other issues of other books where the in and out of the flashback sequences was a little awkward. So I think they did a good job here. And frankly, I think the art on this book and Irredeemable for that matter is just good stuff. So
yeah. Now, this particular issue I'd give a 4 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a common theme of my rankings this week. But I would say, you know, the combo of Irredeemable and Incorruptible as series, I would give a 5 out of 5.
Yeah, same here. Totally.
Highly recommended. I can't recommend Irredeemable and Incorruptible more.
Yeah. I would say overall for both titles, there have been a few that have been that 5 out of 5 as individual issues. And the majority of them would be kind of at that 4 out of 5 level. For me, this was totally a 4 out of 5. I would be hard-pressed to name any issue of either book that dropped below that.
Yeah.
It's consistently good quality, and again, the title is greater than any individual issue, and to me, that's what I really enjoy. I like a book where I feel there's a both a sense of reality and a sense of, if I wanted to go back and kind of dig out what's the implied backstory that's been hinted at and stuff in these two books and dive into that and whatnot, that it'd be worthwhile to try to extract that, because I'm pretty sure Wade has that pretty crystal clear in his mind and is just giving us the little, you know, breadcrumbs a piece at a time until we have enough that we should have been able to put it together and then say, okay, here's what you should have figured out, you know. In other words, he's playing really fair with the continuity and the backstory. And in this day and age where Marvel and DC have a happy-go-lucky attitude of that sort of a thing, I'm really enjoying this. But that's just me and the sort of stuff I like.
Right. We've got an extra book to look at, too. We've got the Mata Hari preview from Radical. Now, this is a buck, and it's like the first 15 or 16 pages of an upcoming graphic novel that'll be out in the beginning of 2011. So it's really, you know, one of these things where it's kind of setting the stage and giving you a taste for a dollar of something that, you know, is going to cost $20 when it comes out, and that you can look at it and say, oh, okay, I think I want to try this one out.
Yeah, I think as a promotional and marketing move, this was brilliant. Because a $1 intro, you know, versus, like you said, the $20 hardcover. $20, even if I think I really might like the premise, the story, whatever it is from a publisher, do I want to spend the $20 sight unseen? Am I really going to like it? I'm going to have that kind of a hesitation.
Uh-huh.
For a buck, I'm much more willing to try something out. You know, and in this case, like you said, we get 15 out of the 128 pages of that hardcover. It's a good deal for the dollar, and it's a good sampler sort of a thing. This is something that I really think more publishers, particularly independent publishers that are doing more of the hardcover stuff, should be doing, because it lowers that entry barrier to a low enough level that people are going to be, yeah, what the heck, I'll give it a shot. And getting people to try the material is the hard part of the battle these days.
Now,
go ahead.
Yeah, that said, so I read the first, whatever pages. Now, I like, it's not a standalone story, right? It's because it is a story fragment that's leading into the graphic novel. But as a teaser for the graphic novel, it definitely, at least for me, it got me to say, okay, I want to read this graphic novel when it comes out. I mean, the art I loved. They've got this story device that they're going in where they've got some young girl, and I'm not really sure how this is going to play out, but she's kind of flashing back to some of the Mata Hari stuff and what went on. It's set around World War I. It's got some historical fact pulled in around it. Now, what they did was, the last panel of this is, Mata Hari down on a stage, and you see her from kind of a long distance, and it's, it's kind of like, the first time I saw Mata Hari, this French general who's going to be one of the key characters in the story. And it's kind of teasy in that respect, maybe. And I think maybe the problem is when you're just showing consecutive pages of the story, that's maybe a good place to just chop it off, because if you tell more, it's like, where are you going to get to a point where you actually interact with Mata Hari? It could be, a little bit more into it, because this is, going to be a 128-page graphic novel, and how much are they going to tease you with for a buck here? I read then the text piece at the back by the author, and that was very interesting. Way more about Mata Hari than I had actually known before. There's some historical stuff about Mata Hari that, you always hear the name and you think, oh, exotic spy and everything like that. And it's like, maybe not so much. But a lot of the stuff that they're saying here, did you read the text piece?
Yeah, I actually thought that the 15 pages they gave of the story, first off, were a good sampling, because we get 15 consecutive pages of story, so we know how it's flowing, the story style, the tone, the mechanisms. Just in those pages, we get quite a bit about Mata Hari and the time period, and it sets the scene, and like you said, leaving off with her coming on stage or whatever there, nice kind of a break of, okay, we've given you kind of that prelude, that intro, we're going to roll the movie credits, then we're going to continue in the hardcover sort of a mentality.
Yeah. It's not that they don't talk, it's not that you don't see Mata Hari, right? You do see her, but more in a good way, because it's, you see her in descriptive, someone's narrating it and they're telling you who she is and what she was and all this kind of stuff. You get like four pages of that. So you really get a good feeling for the character that this graphic novel is going to be focusing on. But just when you get to it's like they're telling you that. And, just when you get to the part where you're going to go back and you're going to start seeing the story happening live with you, that's where they cut and say, okay, now go buy the graphic novel if you want to see more. And I thought it was effectively done. But, to me, having this text piece in the back really tied a ribbon on, making me want to go buy this whole thing.
Well, I was going to say, because we get the 15 pages that really set it up and give us a feel for what we're going to get in that hardcover, and then we get a couple of pages about kind of the controversy of, was she a spy, wasn't she a spy, why have these historical documents been locked for 100 years, so we still got another, 5 or 10 before they, I guess 5 or 7 or whatever, before they could possibly become public and stuff, what was the real deal, and the author being very clear of this is just, for him, a fascinating point in history with a lot of story potential, so he's going to take it and tell a story. He's doing, you know, historical fiction, and very clear on the fiction part. Now, I felt that was a really good use of the backup pages. And for people who were a little on the fence, maybe, from the 15 pages of story we got, this gave a good insight into the writer's mind. Personally, while it's a really good work of historical fiction, and I found the where the guy's planning on going to be interesting, I'm just not really much into historical fiction in general. Have no particular interest in Matahari or World War I at all, really. But I think this was an incredibly effective, one-shot leading into a hardcover. As a marketing tool, I thought it was really good, and I think anyone who's remotely interested in historical fiction in general, Matahari, World War I, pick this up for a buck.
Even if you're not, pick it up for a buck if you can find it at the store and give it a read, because, you know, if you read this, first off, for a dollar, you know, the pages of story and art that you get and the backup text piece is way more than worth your money for that buck of entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, first off. And second, it's going to really give you an idea of, you know, you might not have previously liked this sort of thing, but you might look at it and say, wow, based on this, I'm really interested, and maybe I'm going to want to get into this now. You know, so the cost of entry here is really, really low. You know, that's the point that I've got here.
If you think you might be remotely interested in this at all for any reason, pick this issue up. For a buck, you can't go wrong. And even if you're not interested in Matahari, World War I, historical fiction, whatever, if you are interested in marketing comics, pick this up. Because to me, this is an excellent how-to, in a good way, and how to do it right out of marketing a hardcover.
Yeah, I think that Radical does a lot of things right that I'd like to see other people doing. And, you know, when you're putting something out as an original graphic novel that's going to be $20, and it's by a creative team that, I mean, I personally am not familiar with. I mean, I could do an internet search, but I mean, I have not seen Rich Wilkes writing before, or I'm not remembering it off the top of my head.
The creative team's not on your radar is what it comes down to.
The artists I'm not, you know, familiar with, so me going out and asking for my comic shop to order me a $20 graphic novel, because let's be frank, you know, when you're talking the non-Marvel and DC properties, the chances of there being a lot of $20 graphic novels just getting ordered on spec and laying around in your shop for you to browse is very low indeed. So putting out this for a buck, which has got to be a, you know, zero profit for Radical, you know, covering the printing costs maybe on this, but as a marketing tool, like you said, John, a fabulous, I think. And I would love to see more stuff come out as original graphic novels, so I know that I'm going to get the whole story.
Yeah.
Right? But again, I don't want to have to risk that $20 without seeing what I'm going to get. So the fact that this $1 issue has come out before they have solicited the full graphic novel, so I can read this for a buck, which is a very minimal point of entry for me. It's not like, you know, some places will put out like a $2 or $3 or $4 actually, you know, first issue preview. Well, that's still a decent barrier to entry, because now I spent $4 on something that's just going to get, you know, reprinted in the $20 graphic novel or whatever. Here it's like, that's a buck, you know, kind of a throwaway. Very effective. And even if I'm not going to pick up the graphic novel because I figure it's not my bag, I still don't feel like I didn't get my money's worth out of the dollar. But, you know, for me, I like the historical fiction kind of stuff. And I'm definitely going to be interested in this. But I love the way that they talked about it.
For me, you know, again, it's not my bag, so if they had just solicited the hardcover at $20, I would have said, not going to happen, okay? But so I was completely sold in the negative at that point, you know, had they gone that way. But they didn't. They came out with this. So now that I've read this, I've got an understanding, I'm going in thinking, well, you know, let's see how my order's looking that month. Maybe I'll get it, maybe I won't. But it's got the door open to where it's certainly in that maybe category. In this day and age, even getting into that category of a buyer's mind is not easy. So I really applaud Radical for this sort of a thing. I think Top Cow with their first issue, first look trade paperback they're doing, we're seeing a couple of publishers that are actually trying to get material into people's hands to give it a shot. And any retailer that has not read this, huge mistake. I think whoever's ordering at any given store, when they've got an opportunity to determine, should I order this $20 hardcover or not, based on reading a 15-page story and a couple of pages of backup material about, you know, what the author's thoughts, wow, they're missing an opportunity to get highly informed about a product before it comes out.
Yeah.
So again, kudos to Radical for a really smart marketing move, and more so for executing on it in a very effective manner. I think this was a really good thing. In terms of story content, whatever, I would give this, just for me, a strong 3, maybe a 4, but in terms of overall packaging and the purpose of this as a marketing tool, definite 5 out of 5.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to me, solid 4 out of 5 for me on the content of this issue. But like you said, the marketing, this is like a how-to manual on how to market an original graphic novel, in my opinion. And I wish other publishers would blatantly steal from Radical on how to do this, because it's such a win-win, hopefully. I mean, it's a win for me because, you know, I can have this very low-cost barrier remover, you know, on ordering this property. And hopefully it's a win for Radical, because it will get enough interest in this $1 issue that more people will be asking the shops to buy the full-on thing for them when it comes out.
Yeah, I think it's a win for Radical just in general, but if for no other reason than the goodwill it generates. Because again, they're trying to get the material to where you can try it out affordably, accessibly, and find out if it's right for you. I think they're better off selling you a sampler for $1, where you know, in thinking, I'm going to use this as a barometer to determine if I want the hardcover or not. And if you don't get it, hey, you're out a buck. But if you'd taken a $20 gamble on the hardcover and didn't like it for whatever reason, because it's not your thing, what have you, you're going to be a lot more miffed, you know. So this is just the right mindset to be working in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else did you read this week?
Oh, what else did I read this week? I read a lot of older books. One of the new books that I did, I didn't read that many from this week's shipment, although I did read Wolverine number 1, which I actually quite liked. I'm actually going to be giving this series a spin. I like the art. I didn't know everything about, you know, I don't know who this girlfriend is or where she got introduced, but I don't think I needed to. They gave me enough in the story to kind of follow along with what's going on, and I thought it was kind of an interesting, you know, Wolverine in Hell kind of thing that I'll be reading it ongoing.
I thought it was okay. The whole in hell part, you know, not a huge fan of, but, you know, that's the direction they're going to go. The girlfriend they had set up in a story arc or two back in one of his books, I think it was Wolverine itself. It might have been in Wolverine Weapon X, though, or whichever it just had the Deathlock storyline in it.
And I have not been reading any of those books. I don't know if that's Wolverine Origins or Wolverine.
It was Wolverine Weapon X.
Weapon X, Wolverine, you know.
Wolverine Week 4, Wolverine Week 3 title. Yeah. Too many Wolverine.
I mean,
books.
I like, you know, it's. We were talking about this on the previews conference call that we had this last week as you listened to this. And, you know, it's just franchising some of these characters out so that they've got three or four different books a month. You know, I might like a character enough to read a book about them, but when Marvel makes four books about them, you know, and it's like whatever the character is, you know, it's like I wouldn't mind reading four books about Spider-Man, for instance, necessarily. But somebody else, you know, was on the call. They're like, I don't like Spider-Man that much. I'd read one Spider-Man book. I'm not going to read four Spider-Man books. That's kind of like how I feel about Wolverine. I like Wolverine, fine. I'd read like one Wolverine book if it's well done, but I'm not going to read four Wolverine books. So, you know, as long as they don't tie this over into a whole, you know, five or six other different Wolverine books, so I have to buy those, I'll read this until such a point that they cross this over, at which point I'll probably drop it.
I do think they're overexpanding on quite a few of these lines. At least this was a week where they didn't have multiple books from most franchises coming out. I mean, there were two Shadowland books, but it's not like there were two Avengers books or two Hulk books. Or it always bothers me when they take a property, franchise it out, and then dump all the books of the franchise on the same week. So it's feast or famine, and it just spread it out, guys. I've been doing a lot of reading lately, with the exception of about 10 comics, which are all radical ones, which tend to be self-contained miniseries anyways, and therefore easier to put later in the reading list, even though they're really good stuff. I'm current on my reading. So I was surprised that it was a small week for DC. There were only six books in the DC universe this week, and I got about 45 or 50 books total. So, you know, there just wasn't much from DC coming out.
It's real easy to lose track of it when you get as many books as we do. I mean, I was caught up pretty much 3 weeks ago when I went on vacation, because I, like, you know, we took a driving vacation and Janine drove a lot, and I read a lot of books in the car, you know, and then I would, you know, she'd drive for about 3 or 4 hours. I read, you know, a whole bunch of books, and then I'd drive for 3 or 4 hours. But, you know, then in the last 3 or 4 weeks since then, I haven't read that many books. So, you know, like, oh, I got a big pile again. So
yeah, it's one of those things that if I don't keep up, it's easy for me to suddenly be 100 books behind, you know, and that's no fun. So,
But that said, you know, it is, you know, there are certain books, you know, like kind of my top of the stack ones that I always read when they first come out. But on some of the other ones, I actually don't mind reading two or three issues in a row.
Sometimes I find that actually works better just because it's written more for the trade than for the single issues and you get the narrative flow and stuff. There were a few things that X-Men Forever, I was like 9 issues behind on. So it's, you know, nice to get a good, you know, sense of story momentum there when you read that many back to back. I just don't like being that far behind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, that one comes out like every other week, so it's easy to get way behind on that book. So a lot of good stuff coming out, but I was just surprised just how much stuff is coming out. And then when I got this week's shipment, what I often do when I'm not massively behind on my comics is sort them by Marvel, DC, and other. And sometimes it's interesting just to see the size of those three stacks. And this was another month where, another week, I should say, where a ton of Marvel stuff coming out. And again, a lot of it really good, but I think they're oversaturating, and I think they're going to start burning some people out.
Right.
So, anything else? Does that do it?
I think that does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Adventure Comics number 518 from DC, Invaders Now number 1 from Marvel, and Lucid number 1 from Archaea.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.